Our second case this morning is United States against Page, and I'll remind counsel to make sure you speak directly into the microphone so we can get the recording. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Captain Kyle Killian. I represent the appellant in this case. My name is Corporal Page. Chief Judge Efron, with your permission, I'd ask for 3 minutes of rebuttal time.
May I have it?
Thank you, sir. By characterizing the evidence as uncontradicted in this case, trial counsel was able to point out to the members, first, that appellant had failed to testify. He failed to testify and present any direct evidence of his mistake of fact. Furthermore, he failed to contradict the government's evidence in this case, notably Lance Corporal Richardson's testimony, which the trial counsel considered the uncontradicted facts of the case. The most glaring example of this is when the trial counsel argued to the members, and this is on page 132 of the Joint Appendix, Your Honors, regarding the mistake of fact. He argued, step one, this guy's got to honestly believe and assert that his mistake was honest. I'll leave that to you, gentlemen. This is a clear implication that appellant has a duty to testify or assert something regarding his mistake of fact defense. The trial counsel was using appellant's silence as substantive evidence of guilt against him. And I would point out, as I did in the appellant's brief regarding this case, this court's Moran opinion, where it cited that there is an inference that innocent people have nothing to hide. This is exactly what the trial counsel was using in this case, was pointing out to the members, hey, he must be guilty because he's hiding something. He hasn't testified. Furthermore, the trial counsel, on pages 106 through 108 of the joint appendix, this is his closing argument regarding the uncontradicted facts of the case. On page 106, he starts talking about Lance Corporal Richardson's testimony, and he labeled those facts basically the uncontradicted facts. And notably, on page 108, trial counsel concludes that portion of his argument where he explains that Lance Corporal Richardson paints the picture for you, members. She's a credible witness for the case, and these are the facts that you have in front of you. I say these are uncontradicted facts. They're uncontradicted because there's not someone else there saying that's not what was going on. You don't have something confronting Lance Corporal Richardson saying, that's not what happened. This is, again, a clear indication that Helen has failed to take the stand and testify in this case, or contradict the facts of the case, as the trial counsel pointed out, as testified to by Lance Corporal Richardson.
Counsel, your argument obviously is generally that the trial counsel kept referencing that the evidence was uncontradicted. Is that the limit to your argument? And the reason I ask that question is that on rebuttal, and you just referenced it, the trial counsel said, so one step, this guy has to honestly believe that. He's got to honestly believe and assert that his mistake was honest.
Yes, sir.
Now, that language, and assert that his mistake was honest, could arguably be meant to imply that he needed to testify to that. But I don't see that you make that specific argument, that you pretty much rely on the fact, the uncontroverted comments. Is that part of your argument, or is that just something we shouldn't look at?
Yes, Your Honor, I would include that. I cited that in the brief a couple of times, the mistake of fact argument that we were talking about. And it goes to appellant's failure to testify / produce evidence in this case. So yes, even though it's not using the exact uncontradicted language, it's getting to the same point that appellant hasn't come in here and contradicted anything. He hasn't told you anything more. He hasn't asserted anything on his own behalf. So it does go to his failure to produce evidence in this case.
How do you, as far as the uncontroverted evidence goes, how do you get around the fact that we do have testimony from individuals who saw the victim before, during, and after as to her condition?
Yes, sir.
And so there was somebody else that could testify to that other than Page on all three of those aspects.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and appellant did contradict the testimony through cross-examination, through testimony of other witnesses before, you know, at the smoke pit, she was walking around, hugging other people, talking to other people, she was coherent. And then both again afterwards, we have all the testimony regarding, you know, was she coherent? Was she walking down the hallway? Was she, you know, speaking? Was she responding to stimuli from the medical people? So there was testimony at both ends. What wasn't there was the uncontradicted facts at the time of the rape. And this is Lance Corporal Richardson's testimony alone, because he, trial counsel labeled it as, you know, this is what Lance Corporal Richardson saw right before she left the room, and this is what Lance Corporal Richardson saw at the time she re-entered the room and saw appellant and the alleged victim engaged in sex at that point. What trial counsel was doing was basically asking the members to infer, because this is what Lance Corporal Richardson saw beforehand, right beforehand, and this is what Lance Corporal Richardson saw regarding the level of coherence or non-coherence of the alleged victim, that they must infer that he must be guilty because she was never able to consent. What's missing there is the time period where only appellant is in the room with the alleged victim in this case. And he's the only one who can possibly say, well, no, she was consenting. No, she was...
So you're focusing on the first part of the incident where she may have consented or not, may not have consented, but obviously Richardson was there for part of the incident.
Yes, but after the consent happened, she walked in a couple of minutes after they began having sex. So that from that point on, Richardson could... still, at that moment, appellant's the only one who can contradict Lance Corporal Richardson because he's the only other person in the room, considering that Lance Corporal Campbell doesn't remember anything. So she couldn't come in and say otherwise. So appellant is the only person who can contradict Lance Corporal Richardson at that point. Now, after appellant leaves the room, and you have all the other witnesses explaining, well, here's what we saw. She wasn't coherent. She, you know, in the bathroom, and they came out of the room with the medics, etc. Of course, at that point, all those other people could then contradict the testimony of Lance Corporal Richardson or anyone else.
In light of the numerous witnesses during the entire time frame and the single point of time that you're focusing on, which is when Lance Corporal Richardson was in the room, and in light of the fact that there was no defense objection, why, in the context of all of that, was this plain error?
I would say it's plain error because, first of all, Lance Corporal Page is the only person who can contradict Lance Corporal Richardson's versions of facts. And this court has made it pretty clear that if appellant is the only person who can contradict those facts, then trial counsel's comment regarding the uncontradicted nature, and this comes right out of the Carter case, is... plain error, constitutional error. I would also argue, secondly, that members took this as a comment on the appellant's failure to testify, naturally and necessarily.
How do you know that? Isn't there a presumption that members follow the instructions of the judge? And how do you rebut that presumption, or need you in the context of an HBRD case? Do you understand my question?
Can you ask me again, sir?
You just said that members... What? Oh, Jeff. You just said that the members took it that way. But there is an instruction here on the accused's silence. And in theory, the law presumes that members follow the instructions of the judge in the absence of some evidence that they did not.
Yes, sir.
What is your some evidence that they did not?
I don't have any evidence other than we have a conviction of guilt here, Your Honor. I would argue that given the instruction, first of all, the timing of the instruction that you're referencing was given after the arguments of counsel and after they had taken, I believe, about an hour and a half break for lunch. When the members came back to the courtroom, the military judge then concluded with his final instructions and then went into deliberation. So given the time period of all the time that had elapsed there, it wasn't fresh, the instruction, the standard instruction that we're talking about, which I don't believe is a curative instruction because it isn't pointing out what was wrong about the trial counsel's argument. As I cited the Mobley and Adorama cases, there the instructions actually gave some context to the...
So timing and granularity, let me ask my next question then.
Yes, sir.
If if ordinarily, understanding your response, members are presumed to follow the instructions, and you would have the burden of indicating that they didn't. What happens in a case where, assuming error of constitutional proportion, the burden of proving no prejudice shifts back to the government?
Yes, sir.
What's the interplay between the presumption that members follow instructions and the government's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the plain error did not contribute to the verdict?
I'm understanding you correct. If I can just make sure I understand this, sir. So you're saying that what the government has to prove to show that the members didn't follow the judge's instructions, sir?
If you are correct that there was an improper argument of constitutional proportion that amounted to a plain error, then the government's burden is to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the verdict. However, in the context of instructions where members are presumed to follow those instructions, usually the burden is on the appellant to demonstrate in what manner why that presumption is undercut.
Yes, sir.
So who's got the burden here?
Government does, sir.
Surprise!
Yes, sir.
I didn't expect that. This is your opportunity to offer some analysis on that other than a flat conclusion.
Okay, sir.
Perhaps the government will get up and say, sure, we have the burden, but first the appellant has to put it in play.
Yes, sir.
So what's your response going to be?
Well, regarding the instruction that was given, again, it was a standard instruction. So there wasn't any curative effect to it. But beyond that, what we're talking about is trying to take away the adverse inferences that the members are going to make. And in this case, there was no instruction given regarding trial counsel's argument regarding a mistake of fact, and the appellant has to assert something, the appellant has to testify to something. There was no instruction that took away any adverse inference regarding that. Just the garden variety standard instruction that, appellant has the right to remain silent and no adverse inferences can be taken against him doesn't get over the fact that trial counsel, as the government representative, has just argued to the members, oh, yes, he does. He has to assert
something. Do you have any case law support for the proposition that the judge has a sua sponte duty to provide a particularly shaped instruction at the time?
If I can just have 1 second, Your Honor, I know I do. I'm trying to be honest with you, I'm blanking. I would say the Alameda case, and then also RCM 919. And I concede that the appellant did not object here, so when I read this...
This is a forfeiture case.
Yes, Your Honor. It basically says in the discussion section of RCM 919 that if an objection that an argument is improper is sustained, the military judge should immediately instruct...
That's not this case.
I'm sorry, sir?
That's not this case, of course.
No. Appellant did not object.
Did not object.
I concede that.
What's the relevance of that?
Well, I think that's relevant because that shows that timing of curative instructions is important in the case.
Are a good thing.
Sir?
Are a good thing.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Counsel, if the trial counsel had argued in this case that the defense has presented a variety of witnesses and none of those witnesses contradict any of the government's evidence, would that have been a proper or an improper argument?
Can you say it one more time, sir?
If the trial counsel had said, members of the panel, you've heard the defense witnesses, none of their testimony contradicts the government's evidence, would that be a proper or an improper argument?
It would only be improper if appellant alone was the only person who could contradict the evidence. So,
That argument would be improper if you could identify a situation in which the appellant was the only one who could contradict the evidence?
If it's meant as using the appellant's silence as substantive evidence.
How do we know what's meant? All we have is the plain statement. None of the defense... you've heard the defense witnesses. None of their testimony contradicts what the government's witnesses have said. Why is that? Why does that implicate anything about the defendant?
Because Appellant was the only one who could contradict Lance Corporal Richardson's testimony.
But in my hypothetical, all the government is doing is referring to the witnesses for the defense. He's not saying anything about, there's nothing else to contradict here. He's saying these witnesses have not contradicted.
Because he was pointing out to the members through implication here that Appellant was the one who had contradicted it. And because, as I was trying to explain earlier...
You're giving an answer to this particular case. I'm asking a hypothetical.
Okay, sir.
Try to test how far this proposition goes. My hypothetical is that the prosecutor says, you've heard the defense witnesses. None of those witnesses contradict what the government witnesses have said. Is there anything wrong with that particular argument?
Not necessarily, unless it's meant to clearly imply, using Appellant's substantive evidence of guilt, using it as his silence as substantive evidence of guilt. And in that, you know, given the certain facts of the case that you're talking about, sir. So I think it applies, you got to look at the context of how the argument's made.
What case would stand for the proposition that the prosecution can't point out that people have testified and their testimony doesn't contradict the government's evidence?
I would point to, again, the Carter case, which talks about the, again, in an indecent assault case, the trial counsel labeled the evidence as uncontradicted. And this court found that that was plain error. Because the appellant in that case was the only person who possibly could contradict the victim's testimony in that case.
Is this a plain error case or an HBRD case?
I would argue, first of all, it's plain error, and then also...
Well, if it's plain error, where's the prejudice? You got plenty of evidence apart from...
Mm-hmm.
Where's prejudice?
First, I would say no curative instruction was given, Your Honor. Second, I would say... The trial counsel's argument buttressed the testimony of Lance Corporal Richardson in this case when he called it, my time is up, if I may continue.
Please continue.
Well, I don't see where either of those goes to prejudice.
Andy, I have a question, too.
Because, well, first of all, it was curative instruction. Number two is it buttressed the argument of Lance Corporal Richardson because it made her testimony, the uncontradicted testimony, the facts of the case. And then thirdly, regarding the weight of the evidence in this case. Obviously, there was evidence presented that the alleged victim did not consent or was not able to consent. Appellant did contradict, at least attempted to contradict that evidence through testimony of various witnesses and cross-examination. So when trial counsel gets down to the fact of it, and he's talking about the uncontradicted nature of the testimony, Lance Corporal Richardson's version of the events from the time she leaves that room to the time she walks back in that room, the only person who can contradict that is appellant. And furthermore, he's asking the members to make that inference that these are the facts, this is what we've told you, these are the facts of the case. Appellant hasn't taken the step to contradict those or assert that his mistake was honest in
any way.
Well,
the appellant's put on witnesses. The government's put on witnesses. You know, isn't that just a comment on the state of the evidence?
I don't believe it is, Your Honor, because I think it's a clear implication that appellant has not testified, sir.
Counsel, would you agree that your case would be stronger if the defense had not put on any witnesses?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And wasn't that the case in Carter, the case you referred to before, is that there were no defense witnesses in that case?
There were no defense witnesses.
Thank you.
Sir.
You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Sir.
Counsel for the government.
Morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Lieutenant Commander Paul Bungie, and I, together with Colonel Lufulio, represent the government. The trial counsel in this case, in his closing, properly commented on the evidence and the failure of the appellant to support his own claims. There is only an error of constitutional dimension in a case where the accused alone is the source of the information, or if the jury naturally and necessarily interpret a comment to have a comment on the accused's failure to testify. This case is very distinguishable from United States v. Carter in that there were many other witnesses, and it's a fairly unique sexual assault case in that there was an actual witness to the sex act. In this case, there was no error at all, let alone plain error. And the stage was set way back at the opening argument. Defense counsel, in the record at page 195, told the members that the PFC Campbell victim always had control of her mental faculties, that throughout the period of alcohol consumption and its immediate aftermath, she was talking coherently, cogently, and logically to people, both before and after the incident, and that the appellant, PFC Campbell, had consensual sex. It was the defense that first drew the members' attention to the fact that the defense was offering to show that the appellant and the victim had consensual sex in this case. And where the defense does so, it can't be the government that later makes an error in comments in closing argument. And this case is Lovett v. Ohio.
Just to be clear, there's nothing, understanding that this is plain error and we have the benefit of sitting up here with hours of time to microspec line after line of the proceedings. In your view, in the government's view, there's absolutely nothing in this closing argument that might be improper if objected to at the time it was stated.
That would be a different...
In fact, this will be taught there and after at all JAG schools.
Oh, no, Your Honor, this closing argument...
is a smart aleck thing for me to say. I'm not saying that. But I'm trying to say, is there really nothing in here that's improper?
There is materials that could have been objected to, certainly, and I think trial counsel even admitted this in the debate hearing that he has since learned more and could have done a better job on the closing argument. However, that fact alone, the fact that it could have been done better, doesn't mean that it was plain error or even a
No, no, but I'm focusing in your comment that it was all proper. Your position has been there was no error, period, full stop. Forget whether it was obvious, forget whether there was a prejudice. So
yes,
you're stopping the plain error argument on the error part.
Yes, Your Honor. And
I'm looking through here and I'm seeing a few things that are not, that I thought were, you weren't supposed to do, like say, he's got to honestly believe and assert his mistake was honest. So he has to assert it?
No, because the government has the burden of disproving
that. Okay. So
yes, that is something that could have been objected to, but in the entire context of the case, including the fact that there was no objection or intervention by the military judge, this was not erroneous, and even if an error, certainly didn't rise to the level of plain error.
Which is a little bit more nuanced than just saying there's nothing in here that's
yes,
error, if objected to.
I should have been more clear. The mere fact of using the words, our evidence is uncontradicted, does not automatically trigger an error.
And just as a matter of theory, but not arguing the facts, do you agree that even if the defense puts on evidence, if in fact, as appellant argues, the accused is the only person who could rebut a particular point, and the trial counsel says that point is uncontradicted, would that be error if objected to?
That could be, yes, Your Honor, and
okay.
That would depend on all the facts and circumstances.
So it's not just once you put on defense witnesses, you're allowed to say uncontradicted. It has to be more nuanced than that.
Certainly, Your Honor. Okay. However, it's...
Again, I'm just testing what the box looks like.
And it's... The test is, you know, it's a plain error test. The appellant has a burden of showing it. But ultimately, it's a very fact-specific inquiry that depends very much on the facts of each particular case and the particular context in which these statements were made. So it depends on the actual facts and circumstances of any particular case.
I understood you to say that putting on other witnesses doesn't get it out of plain error, gets it out of HBRD. Is that what you said?
I think that the...
gets it out of the constitutional dimension.
Even if we get to there was an error and there was constitutional error, it's still harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because of the strength of the government.
Well, that's not what I'm asking. Okay, is this plain error case an HBRD case?
Well, I think the court can resolve it. Pardon me.
Well, that's our job. But what do you think?
But could be resolved just on the fact that there was no plain error in the first place and need not even reach the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
I think the question probably is, if it passes the first two hurdles of plain error,
yes,
is it then tested for harmless beyond a reasonable doubt or some other test?
Well, there's error, plain and obvious.
Yeah, this is just for the sake of argument.
Yeah, is it tested for prejudice or is it...
And if it were plain and obvious...
Then there's the third part of the test is that the appellant still has to show that there's some material prejudice to a substantial right.
Right, and the question is, if it's plain and obvious constitutional error...
Yes, oh, then the
burden. And are you applying HBRD or are you applying material prejudice to a substantial right?
I think once there's an error of a constitutional dimension, then the burden would shift to the government to prove harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. Because there you do have the prejudice to a substantial right. The burden shifting is a little confusing. I think it's clear, however, that the burden does rest upon the appellant to clear the plain error hurdles before that burden does shift to the government. Returning again, the specific Supreme Court case was Lovett v. Ohio, which I did not specifically cite in my brief, but it is cited in United States v. Webb, this court's case, where if it is the defense theory or posture of the case that brings the jury's attention to the fact that the accused may have certain evidence and the accused later does not testify, that's that does not create a situation where the government's trial counsel's argument is later in error, because the trial counsel is permitted to comment on the failure of the appellant to support his own claims. And here the defense told the jury that we're going to show, basically, that the appellant and the victim had consensual sex. And that draws the jury's attention towards the appellant. And if he later decides not to testify, that's a framework that he has set up, and that is not an error that is then imputed upon the government counsel. In this case, of course, there were numerous witnesses that testified. The government called...
Just to look at the scope of that, is the government arguing that if the defense says we're going to demonstrate that this was a consensual act, that the prosecution can say... They said they were going to demonstrate this was a consensual act. The defendant hasn't testified. You can take that into account.
Those words, I think, would be unwise.
Well, how far can you go then?
I would say the trial counsel could certainly draw the jury's attention to the fact that at the opening of the case, a defense counsel promised to show you that this was consensual sex, and they have failed to do so. The evidence in this case overwhelmingly shows that the sex was not consensual, that the victim in this particular case was incapable of consenting to an act of sexual intercourse. And that was, in fact, the case here. We had Lance Corporal Richardson, who was an actual eyewitness to the actual act and testified that PFC Campbell was limp and lifeless, was lying in a bed like a rag doll. It is Lance Corporal Kuhn, the other roommate, who was a defense witness. And she admitted on cross-examination that when she first entered the room, very, very shortly after the rape, PFC Campbell was just lying in bed and lying still in the bed and dazing off into space, and that's in the record at page 319. That's a more than appropriate basis for the trial counsel to get up and say, our evidence is uncontradicted, because both the government witness and the defense witness who came in the room almost immediately thereafter both ultimately agreed that she was lying still in the bed, dazing off into space. There was also evidence from at least three witnesses that PFC Campbell failed to cover herself up, that she lay on the floor or lay on the bed exposed. And that, taken together with the expert testimony, that's a significant indicator of somebody who has lost their mental faculties because they're no longer aware of their surroundings and they're leaving themselves exposed, is further evidence that, and if I may be so bold, it's uncontradicted because it's coming out of the witnesses' mouths presented by both sides, that this evidence was indeed uncontradicted. So the use of that word alone is not a trigger that automatically means error. And in this case, the trial counsel was quite correct in saying that the evidence, in fact, was uncontradicted because there was a witness testimony from both sides that tended to show the government's theory of the case, that the victim was completely unaware of her circumstances and not in control of her faculties and incapable of consenting. The parties stipulated in this case that to the sexual intercourse that had occurred. So basically, the only issue for the members to decide in this case was whether or not PSC Campbell was able to give consent or not. The government proved beyond reasonable doubt that she was incapable of giving consent through the testimony of six witnesses on their case in direct and a seventh witness on rebuttal. The defense also very vigorously, through cross-examination of government witnesses as well as through the testimony of their own witnesses, attempted to show that PFC Campbell was, in fact, coherent and in possession of her faculties. The members obviously agreed that the government's case was much stronger, or as the trial counsel put it, uncontroverted ultimately, and found the appellant guilty of the crimes. Given the procedural posture of the case, the sole issue, and the fact that, in fact, the defense failed to contradict the government's evidence, trial counsel's statements were not error. An additional factor that this court may consider is the fact that there was no objection from defense counsel, and the military judge did not intervene. This military judge had intervened on his own during the course of the trial, as I outlined in his brief. The fact that they did not interrupt the closing argument, while not determinative, is a significant factor that this court should consider. In light of all of the circumstances of this case, appellant has failed to carry his burden of showing that there was plain error in this case. Therefore, the government respectfully requests that this court affirm the findings and sentence that the judge approved and affirm below. Thank you.
One of the factors that you pointed out was, in your view, the trial counsel's statements that the evidence was, in fact, uncontradicted, was correct. Does that matter? That is, what if the trial counsel is completely wrong? What if the evidence was contradicted? That wouldn't make any difference for purposes of this analysis, would it?
I don't think it would, because he's just making an argument, and it's not uncommon for counsel on any side to maybe overstate their case, but that's the whole purpose of argument, is to argue the evidence to the members and persuade the members to the correctness of their case. There's no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
How do you deal with the quandary that if it's so plain and obvious and defense counsel didn't object, why don't you have an IAC claim up here?
It was brought at the lower court, sir. It was not brought at this court. The lower court said that it wasn't IAC because the defense counsel believed he could contradict, but point out inconsistencies in the trial counsel's argument that it was uncontradicted.
Did the trial defense counsel provide an affidavit as to why they didn't object?
There was no affidavit. He did testify, ma'am.
And what was his explanation?
Why he didn't object, ma'am? Basically what I was saying, that he believed that the trial counsel's argument wasn't that effective, and he could, by pointing out inconsistencies, show that the evidence was contradicted, basically. So he thought that he could do a better job, and he also said something along the lines that, you know, I don't object to object, I only object if I think I'm going to gain something from it, and he didn't think he was going to gain something from it. He thought his argument would be better served pointing out inconsistencies.
As opposed to highlighting.
Yes, Your Honor. If I may, just getting back to Judge Stuckey's question earlier about the, and I apologize if I didn't think of this, but regarding the timing of instruction, that was the Carter case, because there the trial counsel, there was a military judge instruction, and trial counsel in his rebuttal argument had again explained that everything was uncontradicted. So regarding timing, I think that's an important case.
If you are going to highlight one thing out of the record that screams sui sponte, what item would it be?
I think it's the mistake of fact argument, because that's a misstatement of the law.
The thing on 132?
Yes, sir. And also, again, the whole one page 108, where the trial counsel labeled all the uncontradicted facts numerous times.
give me the one sentence in there that screams sui sponte to you.
Yes, sir. They're uncontradicted because there's not someone else there saying that's not what's going on. You don't have someone confronting Lance Corporal Richardson. And in following that, the trial counsel pointed out it's helpful to the extent that the defense has to put, has got to put something
guys,
on.
Guys, the question was give
one,
me one.
Yes, sir. Very good.
Not read me the record.
Yes, sir. To basically conclude, I wanted to point out that, you know, regarding harmlessness, it's what the members, what would the members have construed trial counsel's argument as an invitation to take account of Appellant's failure to testify? And in this case, in this particular argument, given the facts, this was trial counsel's attempt at pointing out to the members he hasn't testified, he hasn't presented any evidence, or he hasn't contradicted the government's testimony, particularly against Corporal Richardson. So because of that, I think the members took this as an invitation to take account of that, and that led to a guilty finding in this case. So unless there's any other questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Sir.
We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be adjourned.
All rise.